hoping that when I do the next thing, you're going to be able to see the presentation. So let's go for it and try. And if you can't, then we'll have to go to plan B. So if someone can indicate to me whether you can see that.
Yes, we can see it, Pauline.
Brilliant. Okay, so I'm going to go through the presentation. If there's any questions, Naomi, can you let me know? Because I can't, while I'm doing the presentation, I can't see the chat.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so if you can interact with that.
Yeah.
We'll just go from there then, I think.
Great. So, just before you start, sorry. So someone asked in the chat, I believe it was Amy, this will be recorded, it's now recorded. This, including the resources list and the presentation, will be sent to you after the session. There was a bit of a mix-up before the session with the presentation. So I think I sent you a presentation that's cut to come in a few weeks, but all of the correct resources will be sent to you after the session. And yes, I believe that's everything. If anyone else has any other questions, please add into the chat. And myself and Rhianne will be here to support technically.
Okay, just also to say that, you know, what I'm going to cover today will be the main areas. I will flag up other areas of safeguarding that if you want to, you can do some more reading about. I've put in the resource, the NSPCC site, and there's some really good resources on NSPCC. And I would say if you've not actually done any safeguarding training before, a really good backup to what I'm telling you today would be to go on that site and to explore all of the resources that they've got. Because if you've got any further questions, you're going to find the answer there. There's other stuff that I've put on the resource list as well. So just sort of brief learning agreement, just about listening, but also being listened to respect feelings and experiences. Safeguarding is quite a difficult area to deal with as a practitioner. And everybody is affected by their past experiences. And sometimes the feelings of people can be quite raw. So just let's be respectful, be aware of diversity issues, to listen to difference of views, to respect confidentiality, and just remember, please, if you are disclosing or talking about something, that there are other people that are going to be listening to this. And if you're recording it, I guess it will be on the recording as well. So let's just think about if we're talking about, if someone wants a particular piece of information, try to avoid names, scenarios, and we'll do it on the basis of what we can get on a day like this. Take responsibility for your own learning. And as I said to you, I think the NSPCC is a really good backup to this, and to look after yourselves as well. I'm stuck. Here we go. So first of all, I'm just going to cover the law. Legally, staff and volunteers need to be aware of their responsibilities for safeguarding and promote the welfare of children. Safeguarding is everybody's responsibility. Whether you're a volunteer, whether you're a member of staff, whether you're a manager, whether you're a trustee, whoever you are, if you're working for an organisation that works with children and young people, it's your responsibility. And I'm not going to go through these verbatim. I'm going to perhaps flag up a couple here. The main law at the moment is the Children Act, and the Working Together to Safeguard Children is a really, really good document. And I would again say to you, if you've not looked at that and you're starting out on safeguarding, very good document to look at. Serious Crime Act in relation to female genital mutilation and the mandatory reporting of female genital mutilation. I'm going to talk a little bit about that later on. And then there's a Department of Health document about what to do if you're worried about a child being abused, which is actually quite a useful one. So it's everybody's responsibility. So definitions, yeah. Now, it's not possible to give absolute definitions. And what I'm giving you today is taken from the NSPCC. And I'm going to give you quite a bit of detail about the four that I've got listed there. The physical abuse and harm, the emotional abuse, the sexual abuse, child exploitation and neglect. But there are other areas. Now, I was talking to Naomi before we started this, and I've been working in this field for quite a long time. And as the years have gone on, we've added areas as well. But it seems to me that the areas seem to be adding more and more, which is not a bad thing, because it actually gives some clarity as well to areas that came under these four sections. So even though these other areas I'm actually giving you, they do also relate and interrelate with the main areas. So let me start talking about definitions. So safeguarding is promoting the welfare of children. It's about protecting children from maltreatment. It's preventing the impairment of children's health and development. Now, what's become very obvious over the years of safeguarding is that if children are abused, particularly at an early age and even into sort of teenage areas, it actually stunts their developmental growth and their mental growth. And so things that we'll talk about today, it's not just about what they're suffering about at the time of the abuse, it's about the ongoing effect of that abuse to the rest of their lives. And it does affect the children for that goes away because we've made a safeguarding referral and someone's picked this up and done something about it. So, you know, when you're making decisions, you're thinking about what's happening on that particular day at that particular time. You also may come across historical abuse. Historical abuse is where something's happened in the past but wasn't reported at the time. But you also need to be aware that what's happening right then is going to affect the child often for a very long time. It's about ensuring children grow up in circumstances consistent with the provision of safe and effective care and taking action to enable that all children have the best outcomes. It's never failed to amaze me, I have to say, even when children have suffered really quite significant abuse, the capacity that they have to achieve in the future as well. You know, they achieve against all odds sometimes, but sometimes they don't. Yeah, and you will find that there are some children that really do achieve everything in life you'd hope for them, but there are other children where you can see that it's stopped their development. So significant harm. Sorry, I'm just going to shut my window because I can hear a dog barking outside. So if I can hear it, I'm sure you can hear it. Okay, hopefully that'll be a bit better. Significant harm. So significant harm is that harm that has a long-term effect. So ill treatment, including sexual abuse, forms of ill treatment which are not physical, and don't underestimate the effect of mental abuse, yeah? And don't underestimate the effect of neglect as well. We tend to think early on about abuse, which is either sexual or physical. But neglect and mental abuse can be as debilitating as those areas. And it's the impairment of or the avoidable deterioration in the physical and mental health and the impairment of physical, emotional, social or behaviour development. I don't know where you are in your lives and your careers, but you will find that you will come across children and young people that you just know have not developed in a way that they should and seem to be stuck where they are. And you'll often ask yourselves in your careers, what's happened to this child? Whatever's happened to make this child to, you know, present in this way? And often you will find out that there has been something in the past, not always, because some things are organic and are down to genes and physical things rather than emotional, but you will absolutely see some children who are actually quite bright but seem stuck, and that's the impairment of the emotional, social and behavioral development. So I'm going to go through the areas now. So physical abuse, and what you've got here on the slides is only a fraction of what I've given you in handouts and what a fraction of what you'll find on the NSPCC website. So this is just a brief overview for the presentation. So you will need to do some more reading. So physical abuse is deliberately hurting a child and causing injuries such as broken bones, burns and cuts. Now, again, it's not just that. You will find there's other things that you'll come across that could be put into physical abuse. It isn't accidental. Yeah, children who are physically abused suffer from being hit, kicked, poisoned, burned, slapped, or having objects thrown at them. shaking or hitting babies can cause non-accidental head injuries. So I'm sure you've all seen in the news, if you've not come across it so far, where babies have died because of carers, people they know, shaking them. And that is physical abuse as well. Sometimes parents and carers will make up or cause symptoms in the child, perhaps giving them medicine and making the child unwell. This is known as fabricated fabricated illness. It used to be called Munchausen syndrome. Those of you that are a bit older will remember the term Munchausen syndrome, but they now call it fabricated illness. So it's where, let me give you an example of that. Say, for example, you've got a baby who's still having a bottle and the parent will be putting excessive salt in the bottle and giving it to the child, which then obviously makes the child ill. The parent takes the child to the hospital. Everybody's obviously all very concerned about what's made this child ill. And the parent gets something from the attention of what happens at that point in time. Yeah, they become the centre of attention. So they continue to fabricate their child's illness to be this centre of attention. And that's not to say they're not suffering from some illness themselves to do that. But obviously children have died when this has been taken place. So it can be all sorts of things. That's just one example of what a parent may do. I'm going to cover a little bit more. I'll try and remember to come back to this before I finish on that about fabricated illness. But I'm going to go on at the moment. Emotional abuse is the ongoing emotional maltreatment or emotional neglect of the child. Sometimes it's called psychological abuse and can damage a child's emotional health and development. Emotional abuse can involve deliberately trying to scare, silence or humiliate a child. An example of that would be where a child is basically always told that they're no good, they're an idiot, they're never going to come to anything, they're never going to learn anything, they're told to shut up when they speak, they're ignored when they tell their parents that they are hungry. So, you know, it's that where the child is basically not seen as an important person and is deliberately made to feel much smaller than anybody else. Children who are emotionally abused can suffer from another type of abuse or neglect at the same time, but it's not always the case. Now, it's a very hard one to prove. I always found this an interesting one when I was a practitioner, because you can prove quite easily physical abuse. People seem to take sexual abuse very seriously, but when you try to refer emotional abuse, then what happens sometimes is people are trying to look for things to hang on to that they can actually take action on. So with emotional abuse, you need to be recording every incident, yeah, and what happened and who said what. And sometimes emotional abuse isn't just one incident, it's a series of things that a child's told you. So I'm going to come on to recording later, but don't dismiss anything. If a child tells you something and you're feeling uncomfortable, make sure that you record it, the date, what they said, if you can, in their words. And you will find that over a period of time, you'll get a better picture of what's going on. And if you get to the point of where you're really concerned about them, it's always good to have a chat to other professionals. Because if you're going to go to social care, you really need to have good chronological evidence, and also where you can get back up from other agencies that they've also seen what's happening. Okay, they did say a while ago, and I don't think it probably has happened for all sorts of reasons, that they were going to try and concentrate on emotional abuse a bit more, but I think it's still hard to get a response to that one. Sexual abuse. The child is sexually abused when they are forced or persuaded to take part in sexual activities. It doesn't have to be physical contact, and it can happen online. So there's a lot of online abuse that goes on at the moment. It can be somebody showing a child their genitals online or asking the child to do that. It can be as simple as a child that you're working with talking to you about pornographic videos that they've seen in their parents' home. Yeah, it shouldn't happen, and it's a form of abuse. obviously you need to deal with that one in the same way as you need to deal with other referrals, but dealt with in the right way. Sometimes parents don't actually understand the importance of what children see on television or what they can see at a particular time. Sometimes a child, and quite often when the child's young, they won't understand that it's wrong and what's happening to them. They think it's normal. I often think back to when I was a child, which is a while ago now, but you think everybody lives the same way as you when you're a child. You think what you live is the normal for everybody. And sometimes, you know, they'll just quite happily take what's going on in their life. It can involve physical contact such as rape or oral sex, and non-penetrative acts such as masturbation, kissing, rubbing and touching. But it can also involve non-contact things such as sexual images or watching sexual activities or grooming in preparation for abuse. So it can be from the smallest thing around a child watching inappropriate things on a television or a phone or whatever, to you know, the full physical contact where you're getting children actually being penetrated and sexually abused. So, you know, see it as a continuum, yeah, but it's all sexual abuse, and whatever you come across, you need to be talking to somebody about it. Sexual exploitation. There's a lot in the press about sexual exploitation at the moment, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a minute. So child sexual exploitation is a type of sexual abuse in which children are sexually exploited for money, power or status. Children, young people may be tricked into believing they're in a loving and consensual relationship, and often they're given drugs and alcohol when they're older. They may also be groomed online. Now, a little sort of tip here, if you're working with adolescents and you see the signs of sexual exploitation, and you know that those young people are saying being moved from, I don't know, Greenwich to Tower Hamlets to meet with a group of men, that's also trafficking. And you will find, if you're doing a safeguarding referral, if you put trafficking as well as sexual exploitation on your referral, the response will be a lot sounder than if you're just putting sexual exploitation. Okay, so trafficking means moving somebody from one place to another place, yeah, for the gratification of other people. So sexual exploitation can also happen to young people on the whilst on the internet. One of the biggest things for me that came out of the Rochdale case, which was a few years now, and I don't know if any of you have seen the programme on telly, it's worth watching, is that often professionals, and I'm including social care, doctors, nurses, ourselves in that, will have really difficult relationships with some of the young people they work with, because the young people they work with are very challenging. They swear a lot, you know, they're into drugs, you know that they're causing problems at home. And it's very easy to dismiss sexual exploitation as, well, they're loud, you know, whatever I do, they're not going to do anything about it. And that's basically what happened with the Rochdale case. The professionals were dismissing them and saying, oh, they're just loud girls, they're into problems, they, you know, they're always going to be a problem in anything we do. Until that one person, if you watch the case, actually said, there's something going on here, I need to do something with these girls, and basically expose what was happening in Rochdale. So, you know, the kids that you hate working with the most because they might give you the most challenging behaviour are probably the ones that need your patience the most, yeah? So just remember that when you're working with some of those challenging young people. Sexual exploitation happens to girls and boys. It's not just girls, it happens to the boys as well. Often it's not seen with the boys. One of the things to ask yourself is, if you're concerned about somebody, and you're questioning, oh, he's a boy, and is this happening, is to say, well, if that was happening to a girl, would I make a referral? And you will find 9 times out of 10, you'll say yes. And so ask yourselves those questions. If this was a girl, a female, would it be a concern? And if it would be, then it should be a concern for a boy as well. Okay. Oops. Sorry, something else happened then. Okay, neglect and acts of omission. Neglect is an ongoing failure to meet a child's basic needs and can include failing to provide adequate food, shelter, clothing, protect a child from physical and emotional harm or danger and ensure adequate supervision. Ensuring access to appropriate medical care and treatment. A child who is neglected will often suffer from other abuse, and neglect is dangerous and can seriously cause long-term damage. And again, it's one of those things where you really need to collect information and provide as much as you possibly can when you're making a referral.
Sorry, Pauline, just to cut through. We can't actually see your presentation anymore.
Okay, let me come out and go in again, sorry. Let me just see what I can do. Okay, tell me if you can see it.
Right now it's a blank white screen that I can see.
Okay, can you see this?
No.
No?
No.
Okay. Let me just try again. Sorry.
No worries.
Okay. Let me come on to there. Let me share screen. How are we doing there?
Yeah, that's perfect. Ah,
good. Okay, cool. Let me just go on to. So that was neglect. So radicalisation. You'll have seen a lot in the press about radicalisation as well. And it's a very emotive area for a lot of people. And one of the things I think that you have to remember is that, you know, radicalisation is about lots of people. It's not just about the young person you're working with. It's about the knock-on effect to other young people and to the young person's future. I'm not sure at the moment what the sort of feeling is within the discipline about radicalisation, but I'm going to go through this and I just want to point out some things that I think are probably obvious, yeah? So it's the process by which an individual or group comes to adopt increasingly extreme political, social or religious ideals and aspirations. One of the things that you'll find is that you will work with young people and some of them will have views which you don't agree with. And some of them will obviously change their views during that period of time that you're working with them, because that's what young people do. Yeah, they develop, they learn, they explore. But it's extreme political views. It's where you see them getting into arguments with their peers and starting to distance themselves from their peers, maybe making allegiances with people who are of similar mind. So it's a very hard one to pinpoint, but you need to just be aware that often it's quite an extreme change and not a change you would expect to see in an adolescent. Yeah. And it's a change where they will, you know, when you're talking to an adolescent about something, you'll say, yeah, but have you thought of this? And often they'll dismiss you or they'll go, well, no, I haven't. Tell me more about it. It's the ones that come back with the answers to everything often are the ones that actually understand, have been told what the political and religious ideals might be. So it's knowing the young person. You really do need to know the young person to start to pinpoint some of this stuff. I'm not going to go through this in great deal, but there's a PREVENT, which is basically the Counterterrorism and Security Act 2015. And PREVENT works with an organisation, well, it's the same organisation, it's part of it, it's called CHANNEL. And CHANNEL basically works with adults and young people who are being radicalised to reverse the radicalisation. That's the nicest way to put it. You need to report it if you think someone's being radicalised, but you need to be really careful how you do it, because you need to make sure that you're not putting them at risk as well. So the best thing you can do is, if you've got concerns, is to ring your local PREVENT duty people, and you should all have one in your local authority, and have a conversation about what you're seeing, what you're experiencing, what you think might be going on, and take some advice from them. Don't take responsibility for that one, particularly on your own, because there's lots of things that interlay with this one. Okay, other areas of use, harmful sexual abuse. It's where young people develop inappropriate behaviour, which is displayed by children and young people. So it's young children and young people's behaviour that's harmful to other children and young people. So an example of this, and it's an extreme example, I worked quite a while ago at the Maudsley in Bethlehem, and we worked with a young person who'd been abused as a child, and then they wanted to now abuse other children. So it's behaviour of children, young people, that's sexually harmful to other children and young people. You will possibly come across it. It's not the most common thing that you come across, but it's there sometimes. And that's now called harmful sexual behaviour. I've already spoke to you about trafficking and slavery. And child slavery is the enforced exploitation of child for someone else's gain, and child trafficking. And an example of that would be somebody who you come across if you work in a school who has, they'll often be the better behaved. I know this sounds strange, but they'll often be the better behaved child that's come from another place. And they're talking to you about they're living with an aunt or an uncle. And all of a sudden little things start to come out, and they'll tell you that they get up at 5:30 in the morning to get everybody's breakfast ready. And you'll think, well, that's a little bit strange. And then they'll tell you something like they're so tired because before they go to bed, they have to do all the ironing and washing. And, you know, at that point, you should be starting to think there's something not quite going on that's right here. This is a child of 12, 13 that's living with an aunt that seems to be basically a servant to the rest of the family. And you need to start flagging this up to other professionals. They're the ones that you see. There's a lot of child trafficking and slavery that goes under the radar because they're not allowed to go out. Yeah, that basically they're kept in captivation. If you don't see it, there's not an awful lot you can do about it unless you've got some suspicion from something someone else has told you that someone's being held in the house. But the most common one I've come across is where people have been brought from one country to another country and they're basically acting as a servant in that family's home, and you need to report that. And often they are threatened that if they speak to someone, they're going to be in danger. And often there's violence used against them. One of the things you have to consider is if you let that child, after disclosing to you, go back to that home, what danger are you putting them in? So I would always say that it's probably best to get that child in a safe place once they've disclosed to you. Domestic violence, it's about controlling, bullying and threatening between people in a relationship. A child who continually sees domestic violence is being abused. So if a child is continually seeing somebody hitting somebody else, somebody being verbally aggressive to somebody else, they are being abused. And again, it should be reported. Female genital mutilation. This area is changing constantly, and since people have started flagging this up and referring young people to social care, one of the things that has happened is it's now happening. The female genital mutilation is taking place on younger children. So the kids often that are undergoing female genital mutilation now can't even speak. Yeah, they're kids that before they can actually share that what's happening to them. So if you're working in early years, you know, you may come across some children a little bit older that have already experienced female genital mutilation. It's performed by somebody without medical training, and even if they had it, it shouldn't be happening. It does happen in the UK as well as abroad because people got a little bit wise that kids being taken abroad were being looked at. So it's, for me, one of the worst types of abuse. And I think that, you know, if you've got any suspicion of this, you should be talking to somebody about it. Just to give you an overview, and I hope I haven't got these figures wrong, but I'll check them after. I think it was somewhere like Tower Hamlets or Newham, a very high percentage, and the percentage that's in my head, and I don't, Naomi, you might want to correct me if you know this, but this is at the top of my head, was something like I think it was about 15 or 16% of people that presented themselves at maternity had undergone female genital mutilation at a younger age. I might have got those percentages wrong. It might be higher, it might be a little lower, but it was actually quite shocking. So this is older people that were now having children that had undergone female genital mutilation. And bullying, including cyberbullying, is about, you know, pushing, spreading rumours, threatening to undermine someone. And cyberbullying as well is a form of bullying. County lines, it's very similar to the sort of the grooming and exploitation. It's where a group of young people are asked, told, paid, coerced into taking drugs from one area to another. So they might be going from, I don't know, London down to Brighton and dropping off drugs down there and supplying drugs to dealers in other areas. They started doing this because people were picking up adults doing it and they thought it would be easier to get away with children doing it. Although it has been going on a little while, I can honestly say probably 20 years ago, I came across kids that were selling and taking drugs to other places. So it's not absolutely new, but I think people got wise to the fact that people were less likely to stop a child at one point. And that's why this happened. So if you get somebody asking you, I'm just checking the time. Okay, we're good for time. Asking you or disclosing something for you, I would say this is the main things you need to ask yourself. I'm just going to pause there. Is there any questions yet, Naomi, in the... Okay, has anybody got any questions at this point? If you just flag up. I can't see everyone, Naomi, so I'm relying on you to...
Yeah, no, there's nothing in the chat right now.
Okay.
And I can't see any reactions as of yet.
No? Okay. No. Okay, good. Okay. So, safeguarding. I've put on here listening and hearing. Yeah, because sometimes we listen, but we don't hear what people are saying. One of the things that has come out of serious case reviews recently is that the concern over children and young people that have got mental health problems, autism, that might be self-harming, that they were talking to adults, but the adults weren't hearing what they were saying or understanding what they were saying. So what I would say to you is that hearing is one thing, but listening is something else. Yeah. So really think about that one, that I'm listening, but am I really hearing what the young person is saying? And that's why it's important that when someone's disclosing to you, you give them time. You don't rush them. Yeah. If there's a space, you let the space be. And you can say things like, for example, I can see this is difficult for you. I'm just going to let you take your own time. You can say things like, I can see this is difficult for you. Would it help if you wrote something down? But don't push them to talk. Don't do the, and what happened then and what happened then, because you'll close them down. Okay. So if somebody's disclosing something to you, the first thing you need to do is think about where you are. Is it confidential? Do you need to maybe move to another area with them? Who else is around? All of those things you'll get used to thinking if you've not been in the business for that long. So just listen and be supportive. Do not directly question them. The one thing that I have to say to you is, and it's very tempting to ask more questions, because you know, as human beings, we want to know everything about something. Yeah. And if you start asking directed questions, what can happen is that when you make a referral to social care, and I'll give you an example in a minute, social care could say, well, you asked them a leading question. And so it's your fault that they've said this. Or if it does get to court, the judge and the jury, the prosecutor and the person who's defending would also look at those sorts of things. Did you ask a leading question? So please don't directly question them. You can say things like, you want to tell me anything else? An example might be that a young person's come to you for a number of sessions, or you've talked to them a number of times, and they've told you how violent their father is. And you've been sort of hanging with it because they couldn't give you any specific incidents, and they just said to you, oh, he's a bully, he shouts at me. And you say, well, what happens? And they, you know, they cut it off. So, but this particular time, they come in and you look at them and you can see they're distressed and you can see they've got a bruise on the side of their face. And so you go up to them and say, are you okay? Something happened. And they look at you and they say, he hit me. And if you say, was it your father? That's a leading question. Okay. And the courts would say that you put that in them in there. So you need to say to them, okay, come, let's go and have a chat and let's see what we can do to help you. And then you need to ask the question, who? Yeah. Even if you're damn sure that it's the father, you need to ask who and not put that thought in there or that word in their mouth that it was their father. And you need to make sure that you document. I'm going to talk about recording a bit more. So don't ask leading questions. And a leading question is a question that people can answer yes or no to. So that question, was it your father? Yes. Yeah. Shouldn't be asked because the answer would be yes. But if you ask who hit you, they can't answer yes or no. They'd have to tell you who it was. Okay. Assure the person that they are right to talk to you, particularly around things like sexual abuse. Young people obviously are very, very embarrassed and feel awful, and often they feel it's their fault, sadly. And one of the things you have to do is to say, look, I'm really pleased that you've talked to me. You are absolutely right to talk to me right now. I'm really pleased you've come to me. Allow them to recall the events themselves freely. And that's that thing about not pushing them for information. Now, obviously, if you can, and when children are older, they'll understand that you have to write things down. And hopefully when the children are older, you'll have told them that if they tell you something about somebody harming them, you would have to do something about it. So if, and it's always a fine balance. If someone starts to disclose something to you and they ask you, please, can you not tell anyone else? You have to say to them, actually, you know, if you're being harmed, I have to do something about this. And it's right that you do. And you can explain to them why you have to do that. If somebody's right in the middle of telling you exactly what happened to them, you don't want to stop them and go, actually, stop, because I'll have to tell somebody else what you're telling me. Okay, so it's a fine balance. With the younger children, they'll tell you stuff often and they don't realize that you're going to tell someone else because they've not actually thought that through, even though you've probably shared policies with parents. So with the older ones, you can say sometimes, look, you know that I'm going to report, I need to talk to somebody else about this. Can I just write down what you're telling me? With the younger ones, I would probably not do that. I'd try and remember and then write it down immediately afterwards. And when I mean immediately, I don't mean the next day. As soon as you've passed that young person to where they need to be, you could leave them with a colleague for a while, or you're waiting for social care, or once you've taken them to social care, or once they've been allowed to go home, if that's what the decision is, you need to sit down, even if it's past your time of working, because what you recall tomorrow will be different to what you recall today. So nobody minds handwritten notes as the first recording. So please feel free. But when you do those recordings, make sure that they're given to your manager and locked in a cabinet somewhere. Because again, they'll be used as evidence in the future. I used to sit on the safeguarding board in Lewisham and doing serious case reviews. And one of the biggest weaknesses when we were doing serious case reviews were people's recordings, where they hadn't written things down, they hadn't recorded what they've said, they come to the serious case review and give an overview of what happened, and it's not what's written down. So recordings are absolutely essential and important, and I'm going to come back to that a little bit further. So you need to record the time, the day, the date, the location of the conversation, and anyone else who might have been present at that time. And you need to sign your record and hand it to your identified person in your organisation who deals with those procedures. A lot of you will have electronic systems that you record on, and it's absolutely fine. But I would also say that if you can't get onto that electronic system, you need to be making some notes, but you need to make sure it's securely locked away. And then all subsequent events affecting the person need to be recorded. Now, just on this one, say, for example, this child's come to you, or this adolescent's come to you and said, my father had hit me and this is a bruise and blah, 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 blah. And they come back to you the day after and say, and I want to tell you also, they hit me last week and the week before. You can add that to your safeguarding referral that you've done. Yeah, you can get back onto social care and say, look, I want to add these other two issues relating to this disclosure. However, if they come back to you and say to you, and I also need to tell you that they've been sexually abusing me for the last 2 years, then it's a fresh referral. Now, social care may well argue with you over that one, but it's a completely different type of referral. And what's happened in the past sometimes is one issue has got lost in the original referral, and so it's not taken so seriously. So the training I'm doing with the managers, I talk about what your thresholds are and what your practices are. And I don't want to sound negative about social care, but sometimes social care have to keep their referral numbers down. And they'll ask your organisation sometimes to do things that you don't feel comfortable with. And what I would say is if an organisation doesn't feel comfortable, then they should be doing what they think is right. Yeah. And most social workers, if I'm honest, would actually agree with that. But there's pressure being a social worker to do things in certain ways and to keep numbers as people want them. So think about, is it the same referral or is it something totally different? Okay. So recording. As I said to you, recording is probably one of the most important things that you'll do. And it's the thing I think as practitioners that we hate the most, whatever we do, because we want to be with the young people. We want to be doing stuff. We want to be taking action and we don't want to be sitting down in front of a screen or on a piece of paper. But your recording is absolutely essential and important in relation to safeguarding and in relation to that stuff that I talked about earlier about chronologies of events and information that you're gathering. So record as soon as possible. No jargon or initials. You know, if I'm looking at a serious case review that was 10 years ago and I'm reading through case notes and I see something that says JL slapped SC around the face before hitting whoever the person is that you're looking at, you haven't got a clue who it is. And often, you know, nobody will know who JL is 10 years later. So no jargon and initials. You've got to think about confidentiality when you're sharing documents. Electronic systems should be secure, but if you're writing down, you can use initials, but you need to then put in the file who it is that you're actually talking about at some point. Okay. If you're sharing documents via email, you need to make sure it's shared in a locked password protect document. Okay, else otherwise, if your systems are not encrypted, if you're going from a personal email particularly, people could get into it. Do not change original recordings. Now, if you change a recording on a computer system, it will show up that it was changed and the date it was changed. Okay, if you change a recording on a written system, people will use that as evidence that you're changing evidence. Why did you change evidence? You can always add notes. Put an asterisk and put, I also remembered the day after that this was said to me, and date and sign it. So don't change recordings. It'll be seen as tampering with evidence. If you can, use the child or vulnerable young person's language. It's very, very hard to remember exactly what young people say to you when you're listening to a disclosure, but sometimes you'll remember a sentence that they used and you think actually that was quite poignant. If you can use their language, please use it because it really does help. If you can't, just record it in your own language. You can say, this is what, you know, this is what the young person told me, but not in this was not in their language. This was what they told me and how I've written it. Third person information needs to be shown as such. So if somebody comes into your project agency and tells you that so-and-so's mother is abusing them, then you need to record that actually that person, and again you need to say who it was, and if it's someone that's rung you and is anonymous, you can say that on your records, but you need to say it's third party information. Now on electronic systems there's a way to record information that's confidential as well as information that the young person and family can have access to. So you have to be very careful how you're getting your records together because somebody wouldn't naturally always have information to information around what a third party has said. So some of those things need to be thought about as well. The nature of the contact, was it on the phone? Was it Skype? Was it face-to-face? Where was it? Who, where and when it happened? If there's any injuries, the nature of those injuries, have people seen body maps where you mark where a bruise might be? There's a, basically it's a drawing of a an outline of a child and marking where a bruise might be or of a face. So nature of injuries and where they were, and date and time and signature. One of the biggest things that people forget to do sometimes is if you're having a conversation with your manager about someone and they go, okay, I can see you're concerned, but let's just leave it and let's catch up with them next week and say what they're saying, because it's not an immediate, it's a safeguarding concern, but we're concerned. You need to be writing down the reason for non-action, not just leaving it blank. So you need to say something like, I spoke to my manager, we discussed A, B, C, D, and my manager advised that we leave this until I meet with the young person next week. Okay, so the reason for non-action has to be down there as well. Okay, so one of the things I would say to you is if you have a concern about a child or a young person, always talk to your line manager. There's nothing as being stupid when it comes to safeguarding or anything really. If you're concerned, if you're thinking to yourself, I feel uncomfortable, if you're thinking to yourself, actually, their behaviour was so bizarre, I don't quite know what to make of it this week, talk to your line manager. Yeah, just say to them, have you got a minute? Can I just have a chat to you about this? And share your concerns, because that way you're not holding it. That way you're getting lots of different thoughts about what it might be and what you can do next. So never keep a concern about a child and young person to yourself. It's just probably not a good thing to do for you or for them, really. Any questions so far, Naomi, before I go on to making a referral?
No questions. However, Julia did mention a great point about how it's important that before a young person just starts to disclose something to you, you tell them what the consequences, you ask them what the consequences are. Of their discourse, or tell them what the consequences are.
Yeah, that makes sense. I said to you before, that's true, Julia. Yeah, absolutely true. But some of that can be age dependent as well. Yeah, because if you're gonna tell a 5-year-old that, they're not gonna really probably understand what you're saying to them. One, and you're stopping them telling you something. So you do, it's a bit of a judgment call, that one. If you're working with adolescents, I would say to you, yeah, you know, they should know. In fact, you should be telling that when you have your first meeting with them, yeah, that anything they tell you that could harm them, you would have to talk to somebody else about, yeah. And it's really hard judgment call to make, because part of you as a professional wants to make that call at the start, but also part of you knows that actually it's going to close somebody down if you're not careful. How you do that. Do you want to respond to that, Julia? Sorry. You need to put your mic on, yeah?
Hi. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I only work with teenagers, but okay. I have seen some really horrific consequences of disclosures happening and things happening very, very fast and out of pace and out of the child's control. Mm-hmm. As a youth worker, I'm really committed to ensuring that they feel safe and comfortable. Mm-hmm. And so I've gone, hold it, just 1 minute. I have a feeling what you're, you know, because you instinctively know what they're about to tell you something. Mm-hmm. I just want you to know that I'll really support you, whatever you say, but you need to understand that if you start telling me this, I'm going to have to do something about it. So it's just about being really clear, I think.
Yeah.
And I don't work with young, little ones. I work with teenagers, so I'm very, you know.
Yeah. It's a lot easier with teenagers having those conversations than younger children, if I'm honest. You know, and I guess probably you tell young people that when they join your group, that, you know, this is what you'll do for them and this is what you expect from them.
Yeah, I always have very strong ground rules, so we all know where they are. But obviously, as you build up relationships, things always start coming out.
Yeah, I mean, I find it an interesting one, because what I would say to you is that, you know, even when you do that and they say, oh, but I don't want you to tell anybody else, often the older children will go on to tell you, because they're very aware that you will have to tell somebody else.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, it's often used me.
Yeah, but then they can blame you because they told you and you did something about it and it was nothing to do with them because they didn't want you to do anything about it.
It's like a bit of third-party reporting sometimes.
Yeah, which is fine. I mean, that's part of the job, isn't it? Yeah. But it is a lot, it's a lot harder with the younger children to...
Yeah,
to
I could work with little ones, I'd be useless.
Yeah, no, you wouldn't. Okay, shall I go on, yeah?
I have one more question from Dina.
Yeah.
If you would like to ask yourself, please unmute yourself. If not, I can read it out for you. Dina?
Sorry, I was just wondering if after speaking to the child about their issue... and they go home and tell their parents about the conversation you've had with them.
Mm-hmm.
And their parents are almost angry that they've, you know, revealed the what's happening or going on. Mm-hmm. How do you almost prevent or address a situation where parents maybe become angry towards the child because of this, or come and are quite angry and abusive towards you? Like, how would you...
Yeah. I mean, if the parent is the parent or the carer is the abuser, yeah, then really you shouldn't be letting the child go straight home, okay? You should be letting social care take that lead. And I can give you a bit of an example of that, if you like, and they will be angry with you. And it's just sort of something that you have to deal with sometimes. And it's harder if you're working within your own community. But so, for example, an example that I had of a child who came and told me that their father was hitting them with a belt, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And basically described the dad taking off his leather belt and hitting him over the back, the bare back, because they wanted to do this and they wanted to do that and the father didn't want them to. And we had the problem that English wasn't the first language of the family, so the parents spoke very little English. So what we had to do in that case was we didn't let the child go home because the parent was the abuser. But what you have to do is get social care to move quite quickly on those ones, because you need them working with you to, one, protect the child, but also, two, to bring the parent into, and again, depending on the severity of it, into the equation. So what happened in that case was that we got an interpreter quite quickly, luckily enough, and the family were a Vietnamese family, and basically that's how he was brought up. So we also had meetings with the parents around what's acceptable in England and what's not acceptable in England. And he was like, well, this is how my parents did to me. And the young girl was a young woman by that time, and she wanted to do things with her friends. And we also did some work with the family around, you know, like caring for looking after or living with teenagers as well, and what to expect and how to put on boundaries and how to work together as a family. I mean, the outcome was pretty good, I have to say. The family, you know, worked really well together, and the kid was really happy growing up after that point. But I would say if the abuser is the parent, you do not let that child go home.
Okay.
Yeah. And then you have to deal with the flak after. And depending what it is, you know, if it's something like that, then I would say, you know, try and work with the parents as well, if that's part of your role. If it's not, then try and link them up with a parent support agency. But it's not your job, really, unless it is part of your role and you're doing family work, to work with the parents on the case that has arisen. You know, something like sexual abuse or you know, extreme violent behavior towards the child, you just don't need to get involved in that at all, because that's stuff that you need specialists working with the adults on. It's not something that we should be doing as practitioners. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Okay, I'm gonna get on to referring, unless there's anything else at the moment.
Okay. Nothing at the moment.
How are we doing with time?
It's 12 o'clock now.
We're just gone. Okay, making a referral to social care. Your, is that the next slide? Sorry. Yeah, I've got that. Just making sure I've got it on there. So you need to know your safeguarding policy. I'm assuming that everybody's got safeguarding policies in their organisations. If you're a very small organisation and you haven't, I would suggest that you actually get one written up quite quickly. There are some very good templates, and I'm sure if you haven't got one, Naomi can send you some links to, and if you can't, Naomi, let me know, and to links to sample safeguarding policies that people could adopt, yeah?
Okay, great.
Okay, but you need a safeguarding policy because you need to be making sure that everybody understands the procedures that you're following. And if you've got a safeguarding concern, the information you should be gathering is relevant details of the person you're concerned about. So if it's the young person, some of the things you may or may not know already is obviously where they're living, who their family members are, obviously their age. You need to know if you're aware of any other agencies that are working with young people. And when I talk about other agencies, I don't mean specialist agencies. You have to remember as well, people like health visitors, schools, doctors, yeah, they'll all have contact, hopefully, with the young person that you're dealing with at some point. So think about it, you know, wider around who has contact with this child. You need to be sort of clear on the safeguard and referral. What is your involvement with the person? Are you the youth worker? Are you a counsellor? Are you doing one-to-one work but you're not a counsellor? And you know, what, give them an idea of you know, your association, the nature of the concern. I've seen some really badly written safeguarding referrals that basically are like someone's vomited on the page a number of words, and you have to really like work your way through it to really understand what's happened to the child. And honestly, you won't believe some of them that I've seen. So you need to be clear and concise. You need to say what you think the concern is. You need to say what the evidence of the concern is and what the signs that you can physically see, as well as what the young person's told you, if there are any. And please be clear, you know, writing something like, oh, they come into my office and then they collapsed in tears and they were sobbing for 10 minutes and I asked them what was wrong and then they said he'd hit me and then I said, who's hit you? You know, things like that just really are not useful when you're making a referral. So you need to say, young person arrived at the office, they were distressed, I gave them time. Once they got themselves together, they told me that somebody had hit them. I asked them who, they said that it was their father. I noticed that there was a bruise on their left cheek. I've now made a map. So yeah, so concise. My concerns are A, B, C, D, yeah? So if there is an alleged perpetrator, someone accused of being responsible, or of any other identifiable information, such as their name or their employment details. Now, most kids are abused by somebody they know at some point. So it may be someone that's not a parent that's associated with their family, and they only know their name is, I don't know, Michael, but they know that they work for the electric company or Skybox company, yeah? So they know that it's a friend of their dad's or someone that their dad uses to do work in the home. So it's those sorts of things, if you don't know exactly who it is, that's useful. Whether you've spoken to the person, family member or others about your concern. Now, with say some of the low level neglect, emotional abuse, you may have had parents in and say, look, we've got concerns. They've told us that you're speaking to them in this way. You know, it's not appropriate, it's really having an effect on them, you know, do you need some help to deal with this? And they might said, oh no, I didn't realize, I won't do it again, and then this has then escalated. So if it's extreme abuse, you don't talk to the person or the family or members until you've spoken to social care, okay, because it puts the kid more at risk. And then details of other services that the young persons are involved in, if you know any. Okay.
We have a question, yep, from Zareen. She'd like to know how a referral should go if there's a domestic abuse in the household.
Okay. It's very similar. Yeah, you would say that, I guess, I can make up a scenario. Hopefully it'll help. If not, ask me for more specifics. So you would say that, for example, I don't know, let's say you're doing some one-to-one work with a 12-year-old. So the 12-year-old came into your project and they were very tearful. And you said, what's wrong? It's unlikely, you know, not like you to be so down and tearful. Do you want to talk about what's happened? And you go into, you know, you'll be saying, they came into the project. I looked at them and thought they looked upset. I asked them to come into a room with me and I asked them what was wrong. They told me that just before they left home, their dad had hit their mum. And you would say possibly to a child, you know, tell me what it looked like. And they might say, well, he hit around the head and then he hit her on the nose and the nose was bleeding. You'd recalled that, yeah? The father hit the mother around the head or the partner hit the mother around the head. There was blood coming from the nose. Obviously, this is affecting the child. This is the reason for making this referral. Does that answer your question?
Sorry.
Yeah, sorry, no. So because I work in the domestic abuse sector, the person that I would deal with necessarily would be the mother or the father who is the victim of domestic abuse, okay, as opposed to the children. So I wouldn't necessarily be talking to the children. So obviously when I do see that there is domestic abuse within the household,
yep,
and I do make a safeguarding referral for the children because obviously if there are children in the house, but then sometimes they come back and saying, well, just because there's domestic abuse, what, you have to be more clear about the abuse, how is this affecting the child? But then I haven't necessarily spoken to the child to see how it's affecting the child.
Yeah.
But I do know that what's going on in the household is not good.
Yeah.
And it would have a detrimental effect on the child. Yeah. So how do I avoid referrals being bounced back to me by social services or friends?
I think possibly if you're aware of, if for example, you've got details from the mother of what the domestic abuse looks like, or from the father, if it's the mother abusing the father, if you've got details of what that looks like, yeah. So let's say one of them has told you that, you know, on a Saturday night, regularly, they come in drunk and in front of the child, they'll hit me around the head, kick me, blah, 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 blah. You can give a few more details of what that domestic abuse is rather than just saying it's domestic abuse. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Does that help a bit?
I do give details, but sometimes they say, what specific impact is this having on the child though?
Do you know what I would say to, you know what I would say to them, and this sounds really harsh, but I would say to them, look, you are social care. It's your duty to investigate if you feel a child is being harmed. I'm telling you that this is affecting the child because the domestic abuse is so severe in this household. You have a duty to explore this further. Please contact the school and the youth agencies that you know that child might have. Put it back to them. I know that sounds harsh, but I can't tell you how many times I've banged my head against social services door to get
I know. Believe me, I know this.
You end up having a bruised head in the end, but you know, I think, you know, I've been asked in the past, is this child at risk? And my stock answer is, actually, that's not for me to decide. That is for you to investigate and decide.
Okay, that's a really good answer, actually.
Their duty to explore anything that's referred. Now, when I say they've got to look at, they can do that through other agencies, but they've got to do something. They've got to look further, and if they don't look any further, then they're not doing their job. I would expect them to get in touch with other agencies they know that young person is involved with, and maybe get them to keep an eye as well.
Sure. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So multi-agency safeguarding hubs. Most local authorities have got something now that's called a MESH. And it's basically where the agency decides what sort of intervention is needed for a child or young person. Now, you know, not every child that you refer will need to go on a safeguarding oversight for a period of time, but it might be that there be other agencies involved to support the family and the child. And the job of the multi-agency safeguarding hub is to negotiate the other agencies and who's going to take sort of the responsibility at that time for whatever's going on. So that's probably a bit of an answer to your question. Because what they could do is they could say, well, actually, this child is mostly attending school, Let's ask the school to make sure that this child is getting that little bit of extra attention and making sure that, you know, there's nothing that's coming from the child that's detrimental that's not being reported. So basically, it doesn't mean that there's going to be, you know, a concern wrapped around the child, but it means that people decide what the best interventions are. But you would still, if you think it's safeguarding, you make a safeguarding referral. It's not your decision. It's not for you to choose. It's for them to make that decision about where they think the best support is available. You may already have that. And I would say, you know, if you already have in your mind something that could help them get the support for the child, then suggest it to them as well. But don't take responsibility for doing it unless you're the named person that's named in that case conference or case review. So if you go onto a local authority's website and you put a safeguarding referral for a child, you should get up the form, which is often, oh, it's now probably in most of them, an electronic form that you have to fill in. Anybody come across nothing but, you know, anything but electronic forms now? I think most places have got electronic forms for referrals. I could be wrong. Okay, so once you reported the concern, they will decide who, if the referral meets the criteria to act. And I know you're going to laugh, some of you, when I say this, but they should inform you within 48 hours what they're going to do, whether they're going to act, not act, what they're going to do. And I know that that probably doesn't happen in most cases, but I would say to you, if you make yourself enough of a pain, they'll start doing it because they know you're going to ring them within after the 48 hours and ask them what's happening. So get to know your social care people as well as you can if you're dealing with referrals consistently, and get them to know that you actually expect a response in 48 hours. As I say, you'll probably most times have to follow it up, and you should be recording what the response of social care is on your records as well. Any questions on that bit?
None right now.
You're okay with that? Okay, I always think about it in this way, around essentials. So it's being able to recognise when a safeguarding issue is a safeguarding issue, knowing what you should do to respond, making sure that you actually refer it and record what it is that you've done, yeah, right through that process. So I call that the four R's because I think it's an easy one to remember. So it's recognise, respond, refer and record. And they're all really important points to remember when you're making a safeguarding referral. Okay, I think we're there. So I'm going to come get rid of my presentation and hopefully I can start to see people. Cool. That reason all my things are coming up. Okay, right, I'm opening up now for any questions, any debates, any thoughts that anybody has. So you can either flag up with a hand out of the reactions section, or you can wave at me, or is that a wave, Jordana, or is that just a picture?
It's
just a picture. Okay, is there any more on the chat?
No more on the chat. Jordana said that was great.
Ah, good.
Agreed. Very informative.
Good. Thank you. I'm really happy for questions, or if anyone's got a specific thing like the one we've just had, I'm happy to give some feedback. You know, I haven't got the answer to everything, I have to say, but it's good to have a debate if there's certain things that you're concerned about.
Dina? Yeah.
I'm going to try and word this properly. So with the issue I raised earlier, it was said that you would keep the child with you and you wouldn't let them go home. Mm-hmm. What sort of situations would you allow for the child to return home after they've addressed an issue?
Yeah, to be honest, if I was making a safeguarding referral, I would not take the responsibility for returning them home. I would leave that up to social care.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you're making a safeguarding referral, you need to talk to social care and say, the child's with me now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We either need to find a place of safety where they can go to. Sometimes it's an aunt or uncle, but obviously you have to let the parents know that's what's happening. Or not you, but social care will need to let the parents know that's what's happening.
Okay.
Yeah, because it could be disastrous. Yeah, you know, even someone who's had low level abuse, you know, being sent home, they could just disappear, or they could be significantly harmed, and you can't take the responsibility for that.
Mm-hmm.
So don't do anything without social care's advice, basically. Okay. And don't be frightened of social care. I have to say that, you know, after years of working in the field, when I first started working, I sort of tended to think that social care knew more than anybody else. And this is not detrimental to social workers, let me say, because I think most social workers would want to do their job in a way that protects young people. But there is so much pressure sometimes to lower thresholds, to not take official referrals, to implement other agencies to take responsibility. And sometimes it's appropriate, but sometimes it isn't. And if you don't feel it's appropriate, you know, make sure you say it's not appropriate and the reasons why, and follow that up in writing. Yeah, don't feel just because somebody's a social worker that they understand the child and know the circumstances more than you do, because often they don't. And, you know, you've worked with a kid for, say, 2 years sometimes, and you'll be making a referral based on your knowledge of that child and the family, and they'll have never come across them before. And they're making their decision on something that you've written on paper, which is good, and that's why it's important that your recordings are good. But actually, if you know more, don't step back. Just go, actually, no, you've got this wrong because. And no one's going to shoot you for that. Yeah?
Okay.
Yeah. Marcia?
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I just want to sort of say what you've just said there is great, because being a practitioner or a practitioner myself, it's, as you say, a lot of people are frightened of social care, think, as you say, that they know everything, they're going to make it the right decisions. Be prepared to challenge them, to challenge them in a professional way. But I say to my staff, if you feel that there's something not right, our gut instinct is normally right, listen to that and say, don't be afraid to challenge them.
Yeah. And I think gut instinct is good. You know, I would say 99.9% of the time, your gut tells you something, sometimes your brain doesn't tell you. And I think gut instinct is actually quite a good thing to go with. But you need, obviously you need evidence of what your gut's telling you. You know, I started years ago as a parent support worker. And so I was working with parents, and I remember very early on sort of starting to think, it doesn't feel right what they're telling me they're doing. It just doesn't, but I didn't have the nerve or the confidence at that point to challenge. And it obviously, that grew out of frustration, I have to say, as well as need. But I, you know, I seriously have had some serious conversations with social workers. But also, you know, one of the things you need to remember is, particularly if you're with from bigger organisations, you've got people above you who are CEOs, head of services, and, you know, those sorts of roles. And there's nothing wrong about you escalating it up your organisation to get your CEO to write the head to the head of social care if you're really concerned about a young person. And I've done that before. You know, I knew a couple of heads of social care because of, as time went on, you know, my roles changed and I did other things. And I used it sparingly, but if I felt that someone was blocking me in social care, I would get onto the head of social care and say, look, I'm concerned because, and 9 times out of 10, they'd say to me, okay, I'm going to look into it. And then you'd get something back that was, you know, a little bit more positive. So, you know, I've got both youth and community work and social work qualifications. And, you know, I would say that sometimes because you're working face to face with such a diverse group of people as youth and community workers, and, you know, your knowledge is second to none to what some of the social workers are. And that's not detrimental, because social workers are limited often on what they can do now. You know, your knowledge is worth having. Your knowledge is strong, and you need to be, you know, taking ownership of that. Any more questions?
Can I? Hello. Thank you. That was such a great talk, Pauline. I wanted to ask, I know you mentioned the MASH team. Mm-hmm. So that would be our first, that would be our first point of contact. Like if we suspected anything, that's who we'd call.
Your first point of contact if you suspect child abuse is the duty line, the social care duty line, yeah? And when you make your referral, what often happens is that referral goes to the MASH team to then be decided what support is needed. But your first port of recall is the duty line, the duty phone line, you know, to make the verbal referral and then filling in your form and sending that. Yeah.
Okay. And then what would it practically look like? So most youth clubs are kind of in the evenings. Mm-hmm. And then say if something's disclosed, like I can't remember the other lady that was asking the question. And then we would make a phone call. Those are out of office hours. So they have those, they have out of office hours lines available.
Yeah.
And then like, can we suggest that they would be sent to another family member? How would it work? You know, would they normally be placed, like you said, you mentioned an aunt or is that the normal procedure or is it?
It depends. Yeah. It depends on the case, and it really depends on the case, because sometimes you might find yourself taking them up to the social service office, even though it's closed. They'll have, you know, emergency services.
Pauline?
Yeah?
Surely the first point of contact is your child protection officer in your team. So you'd go through your manager first before you actually went through to the local authority.
Yeah, we're talking about contact with the local authority, I think. Yeah. We were talking about contact with the local authority.
Okay, it's just...
You're right, Julia. You would talk to your manager first, but once you've made that decision, then you would be contacting
up to me.
Sorry, say again.
I say that's my role as a manager when people refer it up to me.
Yeah, but different people have got different structures for reporting safeguarding. And if it's out of hours...
The organisation had to have a named safeguarding officer.
Yeah.
So you would
It doesn't necessarily mean that that person makes the referrals. They can delegate the referral to somebody else. And if you're out of hours and you can't get your safeguarding officer and you're working in a youth service, you would make a referral directly.
You would still have the mechanisms to do that.
Oh, that's really good. That's really good. But not all agencies have.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and not all youth workers will be able to get their manager out of hours. They should, but sometimes it doesn't happen. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So going back to what you're saying, Jordana, yeah, I would say I would be talking to the young person and explain to the young person, look, you know, it's not safe at the moment for you to go home because of what's happened, and I would like to talk to social care. You've already had that conversation that you're going to have to talk to someone. Yeah, I'm going to talk to social care. Is there anywhere that you would feel safe if they ask me?
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they might say, yeah, you know, I would go and stay with my sister. They live in Brighton or somewhere and I'll be fine there. But you can suggest it, but it's not your responsibility for you to decide where they go. It's social care's responsibility.
Yeah. It's just that I've had a case where, not actually with my work, this is actually with someone that is a neighbour, and who had her children removed. You know, it wasn't really her fault, but what happened was the children ended up not with family. Mm-hmm. And then she suspected that her children were being abused. Mm-hmm. And just the way that, you know, like we're talking about gut instinct, and then it then got looked into, and they were now put with the foster carer, who's much better. But when they went to court, the judge was like, I don't understand why these children are not with family. So I was asking that, is it protocol normally that it would, because it makes more sense, because it would be a bit worrying to refer them to like a random person, you know. I know it's not up to me, but I just wanted to know you know, you were talking about, you know, engaging with social services and not being afraid to speak up and things like that. Is it something that we can kind of say, you know, this is a safe place that they have requested? Is
yeah, you can't say it's a safe place because you don't know, but you could yeah. you could say they've asked if they could go and stay with their sister in Brighton because they would feel safe yeah. there. Yeah. Okay. And then yeah. social care would look into whether it is a safe place for them to be. It's difficult because, you know, not also it's like the world, really, you know, even people that foster carers sometimes are not nice to children. Yeah. Even though they're paid and vetted and yeah, it still happens in foster care. But it's the social services duty to make sure they're put in a safe place. Yeah. You can say that the young person said that, you know, they would be safe with this person, that person. You know, sometimes social care are looking for a little bit of help as well because they have got a hard job. Yeah. And you know, if they've got someone there at 6 or 7 o'clock at night and it's just the you know, the night staff that are in the social care office, they're going to find it hard to find somewhere for that child that night. And so, you know, but it's not your place to say it's safe. You can yeah. say the child has said that they would feel safe going to, and then it's up to them to make that. And it's then up to them to tell the parents that's where the child is going and what's being said.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Going back to Julia's point, if you have procedures in place where you don't make the referrals and your manager makes a referral, then obviously that's for your manager to deal with. The only little problem I have sometimes with that is that sometimes managers don't have all the information because it's not passed on to them, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you are a practitioner and you're not making referrals yourself, then you need to make sure that your manager has all the information that they need to make a good referral. Because social care is going to go back to your manager, not you, if they've got further questions.
Yeah, yeah? Thank you. Yeah, so, our structure is quite different because I work for a church, but this the youth club that we run is a community youth club. So yeah, it's yeah. not directly within the church timing yeah, yeah. or anything yeah. like that. So mm-hmm. I am kind of in charge, but at the same time, I'm glad we mentioned this because I might actually ask if I can be a safeguarding officer as well, just because it kind of fits more in line with how yeah. our structure is. Yeah. But yeah, we have a meeting. I'm going to bring that up as well.
Ask to go on. I mean, it's not something you might find it useful to go on the manager's training that we're doing next week. Yeah. It's different to this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're basically managing the referrals, it might be useful to go on that. But I think in the longer term, once the world gets back to some sort of normality, ask to go on designated officers safeguarding training.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and that will give you a little bit more as well. But next week's will give you a little bit more to think about.
I've got to come out for that. Yeah, no, this is great. I like to just keep refresh. It's just good. We've done safeguarding, but sometimes you know, you forget things and you need to just keep up to date. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and we are dealing with a whole host of different organisations here. And, you know, like yourself, who's basically having to deal with it on your own. Like Julia's, where she's the manager and she's having to oversee staff and deal with it. Everybody's, you know, coming from a different starting point here. So
yeah thank you.
I saw somebody else. Was it Zareen? Did you put your hand up earlier? No
I didn't know.
Okay. I wasn't sure. I thought I saw your hand wave at one point. Okay, any more questions before we think about closing? Okay, just then, thanks from me. I guess, Naomi, do you want to sort of say something to end about the evaluation and stuff?
Yeah, thank you very much for that, Pauline. It was very informative. And thank you, everyone else, for being engaged and sharing your questions and comments. I know we are just at 12:30 now, but if you could kindly complete the session evaluation. So it's on Mentimeter, and this is an interactive survey. I'm going to share my screen. I've also sent the link and details in the chat, and it's the full benefit of our funders, our trainers and future participants, just to know the areas that, you know, the training met the objective. So I'm going to share my screen, but if you do need to go, that's absolutely fine.
And a thank you from me as well, and hopefully see some of you next week.
Great. So yes, Menti.com. It's at the top. Go to menti.com and please use the code 73, 97, 62 and 4. Thank you for those that have already started filling that in.
So you've sent them that on the communication as well, so they've got that code, yeah?
But yeah, so it's in the chat presently. Mm-hmm. If you do need to leave, that's fine. I'll send it in an email with everything else after this session. But yeah, that was brilliant. Thank you. And we are more than happy to hear your suggestions about future trainings and any comments, really. So feel free to.
Yeah, and any questions you've got, then, you know, if you let Naomi know, either myself or Naomi or someone will come back to you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I've got to go.
Okay. Thank you. Nice to
see
you.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
You should be able to go on to the next questions yourself, but let me know if that's an issue.
Do you want to say it's on the 29th, the next session, isn't it?
Yeah. So Rhianna's just sent in chat details about the next session.
All right. Great. Thanks.
And that one is safeguarding for managers. And it's the same time, 11 till 12:30. Okay. I can't escape this, but I'm assuming that you're able to move on to the next questions. Let me know if you can't.
Yeah, it moves on to the next question.
Okay, perfect.
And we'll be sending out the chat as well. So please feel free to continue to use the chat.
Yes, and then there'll be an audio recording of this. I guess if anyone else wanted to ask any more questions, there's some time now.
I think people are probably just doing the other bit. I love the fact that we have so many different types of organisations when we do these things, because there is a real variety of like structures and setups and different people from different ways doing different work.
And it's all just as important for everyone. Mm.
It's very hard at the moment, I think, to be in the filled with having to deal with like non-contact stuff, really.
She made a note earlier about fabricated illness. Mm-hmm. Did you go over that? Because I think you said you wanted to go over that again.
Oh, sorry. Can't even remember.
But if not,
so don't worry. It wasn't that important, probably.
Okay. If you do remember, send it through to me and then I'll email it to everyone else.
Sometimes things come into my brain while I'm talking and then they go out the other side again once I've stopped.
As with all of us.
I think it was mainly around the age of fabricated illness and children and, you know, the younger, the same as the female genital mutilation issues around, you know, the younger they are, the less likely they're, you know, the more likely they are to be able to tell anybody about it.
Mm-hmm.
Different signs.
Jordana has raised her hand.
Hello, Jordana.
Do you want to make a comment?
Hello. Yeah, it was actually just in general to Partnership for Young London, because I've also been doing the trauma informed practice series. And brilliant. I just want to say, during the lockdown, while I've been on furlough, it's been so great to brush up and to even just have all this training available. Like, thank you guys. Such a great job. And I've been telling other people, like, oh, you should sign up for this. And then every time I'm like, I want to go with all of them. So my manager's like calling me back to work next week. So I'm never going to have to do all these trainings, but it's been so like enriching and, you know, to kind of go back feeling prepared and, you know, so thank you guys. God bless you.
It's a little bit soul destroying, isn't it, Jordana, sometimes being during this time?
Yeah. Well, yes, and I mean, I think it. We just have to, keep that hope, you know, because it is that we're getting so many negative messages, so much unsureness. People are not what's going on. Everyone that's making the rules isn't sure. Everyone's like, what's going on? You know, it's nice to kind of get back to things.
We were saying before we sort of came on the call together how much in the future there's going to be a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
You know, regardless of what's happening now, give it 6 or 7 months, hopefully things start to subside and things start to return to a bit more normal. There's going to be an awful lot of work to do with some of these young people out there, because it's hard enough for us as adults to deal with some of the stuff. But for young people, it must be, you know, really hard to have gone through this.
And so many changes, you know. And stuff. I think the youth services are really important right now.
They just
value that social time, just being able to have fun. Even at school, they've gone back, they were excited, and then they go back and it's like it's not quite the same. And, you know, we're not allowed to do this, we're not allowed to do that. And some of it's confusing because you think they're not allowed to, what was it, they're not allowed to do a few, I think it was have lockers, but then I was thinking, but they're allowed to share knife and fork still. Like, it just doesn't make sense. And I think the best place is, obviously we have to be safe, but I think it's good for us also to kind of not be overly controlling, because that's just even more mentally destructive. So we have to be safe, try and give them a bit of freedom outside and just to for things to be normal, because we've seen the actual statistics show that it's not a, you know, there's a very high recovery. Over 90% of people that actually get COVID recover. But it doesn't even seem like there's even a balance in the amount of
understanding of what makes an issue or sick.
I don't think that people understand it generally. I think that's the problem. Do you know what I mean? I think, you know, worldwide, there's still not an understanding of it, really.
Yeah, we're just doing as we're told kind of thing. But
Yeah.
I was saying to my neighbour today, I said, you know, isolation is what they use in prisons to punish prisoners. So you know that humans are not created to live like this, and it has a lot of detrimental effects. And then you think, are those effects, you know, better than COVID or worse? Because, like, if everyone's going to come up with mental health issues and suicide, you know, then it's like, is it worth it? We've had other things before, like swine flu and other pandemics, even the flu itself. We haven't had this kind of control.
I think it is sort of serious, because I think the problem is that because we've all been in lockdown, it's not as bad as it could have been, if you know what I mean. Can you imagine if you hadn't been in lockdown, how it might have been?
Yeah.
Do you understand what I mean by that?
Yeah, no, we've had to kind of keep safe. But
so I think it's probably, but I think for young people, it's even harder. One, because no, it doesn't really affect them so badly, but they're having to suffer for people, you know, that it does, that are older and ill anyway. But also, you know, part of your development as a, particularly as an adolescent, is your peers, isn't it?
Yeah,
definitely. That's the
hardest bit. It is. And getting your identity is not at home that much anymore sometimes.
It's the last place you want to be, really. Yeah. About 12 to 14 year old, you don't want to be at home.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Oh, but guys, thank you. I have to go, but thank you so much.
Yeah,
I'm going to definitely sign up for next week, but God bless you.
Brilliant. Yeah. Take care. Thank you. Laura's hand is up. Yes. So if you would like to share your comment or question.
I sorted it out. I wasn't going on the second question. I was stuck for a while, and it sorted. I reached the last now. Thank you.
Okay, great. Perfect. So I believe everyone has participated. So thank you very much for that. I think that's all from us.
Okay. Okay, do we want to just catch up when people have gone?
Yes. So thank you everyone again for attending and being engaged. Speak soon.
I think there's just one more.
Did you want to add anything? I don't know what your name is. Galaxy S10 Light.
That's the name of the one.
If not, if you don't mind, I will... Oh, thank you again. Have a lovely day. No, brilliant. You too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Okay, perfect.
Okay, that went pretty great. Well, the time, more than I thought. I was a little bit like, am I going to get all this in, really?
Yeah, I was worried. But no,
got a lot in. Got a really lot in.
It was a lot of information, but, you know, it's like 2.5